my goodness. Joanna Shoup is here.
I'm so excited.
Hi. I'm so excited to be here.
We've had you on once before, Joanna. It was when we talked about Prisoner of My Desire, right?
Yes.
And Roth Kalina. Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Sabine and...
And Rydstrom.
Rydstrom, yes.
You know, confession, you guys, when I finally filled out the IAD spreadsheet, that book ranked real low for me.
I don't understand it.
No, I don't understand either, because empirically, it should work for me on so many levels.
Is it the demons? Is it the horns? Is it the...
No, it's not the horns.
I don't get it.
Very pro-horn. No, it's real weird, but that one... And look, didn't work for me, please. There, I mean, like, that's not a thing with IAD, but, like, it, sure. When you do the rankings and you, like, are forced to rank them in order, it ended up way down for me, which is real
that's
weird.
That's sad. That makes me real sad.
I know. I'm sorry. But what we did in that episode was we really decided that Cressley Cole was writing Prisoner of My Desire fanfic for that one.
True. It's true.
An homage. When you're Cressley Cole, it's an homage. It's illusion or allegory, maybe. It's never fanfic.
No. But I would like the, like, you know what I would like? I would like a special edition Joanna Lindsay, like, box set, hardcover, like, Modern Library style.
Oh, yeah.
And I'd like each one to have a preface written by a romance novelist who has basically rewritten that book. And I would like Cressley to do the Prisoner of My Desire one.
Yes, agreed.
And that's, I'm putting that out into the universe.
Which one would you write the preface for?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I would like to write the preface for Gentle Rogue, only because James Mallory gets bangs. He's so, like, emotional. He's such an emo jerk. I love it. Anyway, welcome everyone to Fated Mates. I am Sarah McLean. I write romance novels and I read romance novels.
I'm Jen Prokop. I am a romance reader and critic.
And we have Joanna Shoup here, one of our very favorites. One of our very favorite people and writers.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be here.
Have you been listening to the myriad events that I've been having online? Probably not, but have your ears been burning is my question. Because I have said again and again in events over the last couple of weeks, like, I really believe you are writing the best romance novels, the best historical romance novels out there right now.
Stop.
I do. I think it's true. I think we're all chasing you right now.
That's so very flattering, and coming from you, that's very high praise. So, well, thank you.
It's the truth. So, and part of the reason why is because you're writing this glorious series right now. So why don't we talk about that? Jen, why don't you talk about your boyfriends and your girlfriends?
Well, before we do that, I want us to talk about the topic. It's kind of like why Joanna's here today.
I was going to back into the topic, but fine.
Allow me to back into the topic. As a framing device for today's conversation.
Teachers.
You can't just launch into the lesson without people knowing what they're going to learn.
You start with action, and then you go back and tell them what the plot is. God.
Come on, Jen.
I don't know you. I don't appreciate any of this.
All right, fine. Drag me. Topic.
I don't want to talk about it. No, you know what? One of the reasons we thought a really fun topic to talk about with Joanna today would be historicals that are not Regency England, essentially, right? And you have a name for them, and I can't remember what it is.
Unusual historicals.
Unusual feels so judgy, but I don't know what else to call them.
I don't know.
Yeah, I guess.
Curious historicals, unique historicals, unexpected historicals.
Surprising historicals. Who's got their thesaurus open?
I don't know. I like unusual because I think often Regencies can feel usual. Like, oh, here's another ballroom. But, like, unusual historicals. And I think it's the scope is very broad in that sense. Like, it could be place, time, even, like, location within
the same time period. Yeah.
Regency, right?
Occupation, class.
First of all, I think unusual is a compliment in my life and work. But so I apologize if anybody has, if I've ever referred to a book as an unusual historical and, like, you have been offended, please know that
Well, that's why I wanted to talk about it first.
I think that we have spent so much time as a genre, like, treading and retreading ballrooms in Mayfair. Mm-hmm. That, and I mean, myself, I'm not, look, I made a living. I make a living on ballrooms in Mayfair. So, but I think that there's something really great every time you open a book and it's somewhere slightly different.
Like, when I think about what I grew up reading, like, there was, like, there's a big sort of American, I think there was, like, a long history of there being American historicals that I look back at them now, and I think that they're largely really problematic.
Sure.
Because they're, like, white people settling.
The American West.
Yes. And it's real manifest destiny without any interrogating about what that means. It's, you know, and I look back on a lot of those now, and I'm like, well, it's uncomfortable for me to go back and read them. I don't enjoy it. And so I think in some ways, when we look at unusual historicals now, I think they're better, you know, and not just the ones, you know, this is not just something I expect Beverly Jenkins to do well, right? But I think everyone writing historicals now is, I don't know, I think there's a lot of people doing more thoughtful work. And so, like, American historicals now appeal to me again in a way that they did not when I think back about reading, you know, about, like, brave white people settling and there being, you know, Native Americans are enemies or, you know, so a lot of that, I think there's a lot of baggage with unusual historicals.
Yeah,
too.
I think that, like, the lens has sort of been removed, like that Vaseline coated lens that American historicals were written with for years has been sort of removed.
And so many of those early ones, like, I mean, the one that instantly comes to mind is Savage Thunder, right?
Oh, yeah.
In part because of the title. It's such a now jarring. I mean, then I can imagine people being like, Savage Thunder is a great title. Like, it says so much about what's inside.
I mean, you think they're talking about thighs. I mean, are they talking about his thighs? Like, that is a great title.
In fact, they are. And so, but now, I mean, you would not, like, instantly you hear that and you have a sort of recoil on that. And I think about the title, the cover of that book too had, you know, it was so Fabio. And the hero of that book is Native American and, you know, the cover copy even is just so, it's just so riddled with flags that we still struggle with. I mean, we say this like, oh, you know, we fixed Native American representation in romance, and we absolutely have not.
No.
Like,
right. No,
but I think we're on a continuum away from this, from Savage Thunder to something else. And I think now with the rise of the necessity for own voices romances, especially in historicals, like we don't have enough. There are not enough own voices historicals out there, and publishing needs to do better, and we need to do better as readers to demand those things. And
right,
but that's why when we were talking earlier today or earlier this week about this episode, I sort of said, you know, I, for example, really loved a Viking book when I was growing up, but those Viking books are also, you know, real problematic consent wise. And so we sort of talked about, well, do we want to go back and talk about old school unusuals? But then we sort of decided among the three of us that we would stay modern because the modern uncommon historical is a really interesting one.
Yeah.
I felt like we should talk about it. I felt like we should at least say that.
Yeah,
right.
And yeah.
I want to revisit Savage Thunder for a quick second because I actually reread part of it for a funny reason a few years ago. And I did not realize. So for those of you that don't know, the main character's name is, I think, Colt Thunder.
Colt Thunder.
So when we, by calling the title Savage Thunder, essentially is like naming our hero as a savage, which is such a coded, not even coded, blatant insult of Native American people. And so to have like old romances and probably, to be honest, some new ones. I'm sure that there are people who've run across, you know, really problematic stuff that's happening now. But I think, you know, I don't want to give like any airtime to that, but it does feel like those are not the things that I'm drawn to anymore. And I understand those old books now in a different and new way.
Completely, completely. But, you know, I've had people say many different people on many occasions say to me personally, when are you going to write Regency again?
Mm. Well, because you started in Regency.
Yeah.
And it's glorious. Like, one of my favorite books of yours is The Lady Hellion.
Well, thank you. But, you know, I really just wrote that series to, like, get my foot in the door in publishing, hoping that I could transition to the Gilded Age, New York. But, and I, so she, you know, many people have said to me, when are you going to write Regency again? Because I would love to be able to read you again.
I don't.
I don't understand it. Yeah.
And they have. And I said, oh, really? And they said, oh, I won't read anything said in America.
And I mean, that's true. Like, we, Jen and I have talked. I don't think we've ever had this conversation on the podcast, but you and I have had this conversation a lot in real life.
Right.
And I think that one of the struggles is, you know, you're always kind of mind blown when I say to you, you know, oh, if you set a book in Scotland, you know, you're going to get fewer readers. Right. Like,
right.
I mean, my Scottish book has sold the least of all of my books, full disclosure, and part of it. And it's because it's Scottish. And you sort of know when you when you dive into Scotland, other writers say to you, oh, well, just be ready. The sales are going to go down. And so, and then, you know, but you write the book you want to write. And then the same thing is true of American. They say, like, oh, if you move somebody out, if you move them out of London, like, America's a real tough sell, right? Which is why, if you think about it, even in those old books that were set in the American West, there was always, like, an English character. An English woman who had been, who had responded to, like, a mail order bride catalog, or like an English character who, well, Joanna, your next book that has an English heroine? No, you've written English heroines coming to America.
Right, that was like the first
series. In the previous series, right.
And that was done intentionally.
Yeah, because you can sort of say, like, oh, well, it's part English, right?
Yep.
Or you think about, even back when you think about the Andersons and the Mallorys, like the mix of Americans and... And these are really interesting. It's really interesting because also I think that there's a time period issue here where you can gloss. I think this is a specifically American reader issue, too. Like, I think British readers are like, I think British readers are a different kind of beast for historicals, because when you write an English set historical, you're really writing it through the lens of Americans.
Of course.
Like, in the way we Vaseline the lens of England, right? Like, we tell ourselves, like, we don't have to deal with slavery because it was banned in England by this time. But, like, fine, but also, like, Victoria was colonizing the world. Like, there's a whole different piece of the puzzle in England. But then you sort of think about the way readers come to America, and, like, London had cobblestones and there was a city, and so it felt sort of urban in the way that, like, it felt in weird ways cleaner. And I often talk about, like, the American West is too dusty. Like,
yeah,
you just feel like it's watching Deadwood, and you're like, everyone here is just so gross, right?
So, did it occur to you, strange, bathing in a tub you've dirtied, coming out thinking you're clean?
You need a bath, Jane.
And I'm gonna fucking take it. I'm raising a general fucking question.
Like, when was the last time Al Swearengen washed his, like, long underwear? Never. Never. And so, this is a real deep cut on Deadwood. But the reality is very true that there's, like, a... It's hard to erase for Americans, I think, for people who lived and grew up in America learning about the American West. Like, it's hard to erase that. The dust, the Steinbeck of it all.
It means American readers don't have to think about slavery.
Exactly.
Right? They don't have to think about the lead up to the Civil War. They don't have to think about genocide of Native Americans and the, you know, Trail of Tears. But I think it also then reinforces, like, a real interesting sort of Eurocentric.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And again, like, I'm not... It's just fascinating.
Well, and there's the added fascination too. I want to come back to, obviously, New York, because my issue with I can't read anything outside of London is, like, Gilded Age New York has all of the trappings of
Regency London. Yeah,
So it's like money, power,
corruption.
Like, yeah. Infrastructure, like all of that stuff is here, too. Here, because I'm in New York. So, but I also want to say there's a really, I think there's some kind of like Anglophilia here too, in a really substantive way, because you can't set a book in Scotland, can't set a book in France.
Yeah, and the thing that when I've asked people, you know, because I. When they tell me they won't read anything set in America, I ask them why. And they say, well, I can't romanticize our history like I can with British history.
So they know it.
But do they know it? Do they really? I mean, how do they think the Dukes made all their money?
No. Yeah. Right.
You know, so, and we also don't know American history like we think we do.
This is obviously true.
Welcome to 2020. Like, we think we know it so well because we've been taught quote unquote history since kindergarten.
Certainly most romance readers wouldn't read like a Civil War era. Like we've always said like Civil War is the true third rail, right? Like you can't romanticize war.
Even though Alyssa Cole did that amazing.
Right. I do think that when it's written by own voices writers who are writing a thoughtful, right. who are doing sure. what Alyssa does or what, you know, Beverly has done, it's a different kind of thing.
Any white writer trying to tackle the Civil War has really got to feel like, well, shit, what if I fuck up and it's Scarlett right. O'Hara and Rhett Butler?
Sure, sure.
And if they aren't thinking that,
they
then
should
that's
be.
Definitely what they're going to
exactly.
do.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. But then again, we romanticize war so much in Regencies. Literally, the Napoleonic Wars were happening during the Regency.
Right.
Like, that's the story that is constantly told when you put a soldier on the page in the Regency. So it's just really interesting. But we seem to be able to avoid it in Regencies, too. Like, oh, he came back from war, but it's fine.
Yeah, it's fine.
Like, but it's like France war, so it's a different kind of war.
Yeah, I mean, there are a bunch of romances that are set in, historical romances that are set in India. You know, that's real problematic.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was not that long ago that I discovered that the Regency was really only like 10 years long.
Because right. it feels like it's 100 years long.
And I was like, what in the hell? And so is it just because of Jane Austen?
Yes.
Yeah.
And hair.
It's hair. It's hair and Austen and the like pristine white cis het anti-Semitic world that hair set down. And so there is a lot of that for sure. But, you know, it's interesting also because, as Joanna said, like readers don't know the history of England. So they don't think about it as much. Or, I mean, I don't want to generalize, but like a lot of readers don't think too hard about the history of England. But I'm right now writing Victoria just became queen in Daring and the Duke. So now I'm squarely in Victorian times, right? Early Victorian. And when I referenced them that way somewhere, someone was like, a reader was like, oh, I don't read Victorian. And I was like, what an interesting thing. Because you'll read 1836, but you won't read 1837.
Wow.
That's a weird thing.
Is that what that means? Or is what they mean, I'm not interested in the Victorian Moors I think I know about that are regressive.
I don't know, because regressive more, like a lot of readers don't even think that, like don't like when Regency heroines are, you know, bolder.
But again, that's a misconception that has been like perpetrated out of, you mm-hmm. know, I just learned through research that nipple piercings were all the rage in Victorian England and Paris. They would go to Paris and get their nipples pierced.
When I'm in Paris,
I'm the chicest of the chic.
Amazing.
I love this.
First of all, I'm putting that in a book somehow.
Of course you are.
Somehow, I'm putting that in a book. But, you know, who would ever have thought? Because we've sure. been taught that Victorians were so repressed, but they really weren't.
What happened to women during the Victorian era happened over years.
Yeah. Did you ever read The French Lieutenant's Woman?
Yeah, of course.
I feel like I read that in high school when I was like also reading romance. So in this book, there's essentially like a dual narrative where it's a, you know, story of this Victorian woman falling in love with, I think, a soldier who comes back or whatever. But the author is also telling sort of like the real story of like Victorian time, like at the right. There's sort of a narrative voice unpacking sort of this mythology of Victorianism.
Yeah.
And it's, and I remember like being really fascinated by it, like both structurally, right? Like baby Jen back when she was 18, but also just like really like the whole idea of the pristine version of something we sell versus like what we historically know is true.
Yes.
And I know that not all historical readers want to do that second thing, but I do.
One thing I would really like, I think would be very interesting, is to know, to ask readers specifically about time periods. Because when they say things like, I don't read Gilded Age, like I won't read outside of Regency England, what I want to know is what is it that is the boundary, right? Because if you don't read, if you don't read outside of Regencies, you don't read Lisa Kleypas, you don't read me, you don't read Joanna, you don't read Sophie Jordan, you don't read Beverly Jenkins, you don't read
Elizabeth Hoyt.
Elizabeth Hoyt, you don't read Eloisa James. There are huge swaths of big historical names that you don't read. And I wonder if they know they don't read Lisa Kleypas. Do you know what I mean? Like maybe they do and they just think that she's
Regency.
Yeah. Right. So yeah. I'm just curious because I think when we talk about, I mean, all of these are what I would refer to as, you know, usual historicals. Like these are all except for Joanna and Beverly. But like, you know, when we're because they're, you know, British set and during the 19th century, mostly late 18th, early 19th century. So but the, you know, I would be very interested if you are a reader out there and you do read historicals, but you don't read outside of the Regency. Would you tell us like what it is that is your boundary? Like, is it the dresses? Is it the
ballrooms?
Is it the Prince Regent? Yeah. Like, are you just super into Prinny? Like, I don't. But like, I think about it and it's definitely, you know, like the two who I can think of who are squarely Regency writers are Julia Quinn and Tessa Dare, and Vanessa Riley writes like squarely in the Regency. Yes. So I'm curious, and please know that we are not judging you. We're just curious, like where, what's the line and how do you draw it?
Joanne, I really want to hear about sort of your process and why you were so interested in Gilded Age New York. But, you know, for me, reading reading Vanessa Riley, reading you, reading Beverly Jenkins, Alyssa Cole, reading, you know, I mean, you know, E.E. Ottman, K.J. Charles, like there's so many people. I want it to be, I'm tired of the ballroom and that's just me. But, you know, those books hold very little interest for me anymore. And maybe it's just because I'm older and I feel like I've read them all. It's hard to make that fresh. But I really love an unusual historical. We're going to talk about a bunch of them today. But I would love to hear about, like, why was Gilded Age New York such a, like, the goal for you to get there?
Well, I grew up reading Edith Wharton. So let's start there. Like, I didn't read Jane Austen until I was in my 30s. And I was like, sure. Okay. Fine.
Right, I guess, all right.
So for me, I grew up reading Edith Wharton and just, I had great-grandparents that came through Ellis Island from Italy. So I have always felt, you know, when we took trips here as a child, here, I say here, because I live outside New York, as a child, so I visited, I saw it, I, you know, I just feel, I guess, a connection with the history to the city. And, the Gilded Age for me is, first of all, there's all the parallels to today that just make it so super relevant for me. You know, the political corruption.
Police corruption in this new one.
Police corruption. The wealth concentrated at the top. The social, you know, you have the comparisons to the Regency with, like, the dresses and the social structure in old New York. It's also, we see the explosion of all the technology that, you know, that comes in the progressive age. So for me, all of that has always been, I've just been fascinated by it. So like I said, I always had the intention of writing in the Gilded Age. It has been a little bit, you know, for the reasons we've talked about, an uphill climb.
Exactly. So, but there are classic romances that are Gilded Age set.
Megan McKinney wrote Lions and Lace.
Yes, Megan McKinney, who, you know, sadly...
Problematic.
Yeah, as a human.
Yes, so. As a human.
Check Wikipedia, everyone.
I'll put it in show notes. Like,
Lions and Lace was one I read, you know, when it came out in the early 90s. And that was super formative. Like, you want to talk books that blooded me. Like, Lions and Lace is right up there.
Do you know, I, too, was blooded by a Megan McKinney book. And I made, and we were going to do it. And oh, I made yeah. Jen read it. And she was like, we cannot do this book.
When Dawn Tames the...
Till Dawn Tames the Night. Yeah. Oh, and it's like the worst possible. Talk about, but also an unusual historical, Pirates in the Caribbean.
Yeah.
But that's why that alone, you now know right. why it's problematic. So
right.
In the 1700s.
Yeah. Lions and Lace is set in New York. Irish hero, a society heroine. So there's all the class conflict.
Well, this is the thing. This is the thing about Gilded Age New York that one of the cornerstone conflicts of a historical, of a Regency historical, is class. Without class, I mean, obviously there are lots of like rich, you know, both sides are perfectly comfortable. So that inherent class difference is so easily replicable in Gilded New York. Like, you have such a class system in Gilded Age.
Right. And that was what was fascinating for me to explore for this series, because... you know, all of the excitement was happening downtown.
Sure.
I mean, once you get south of 34th Street, you have the Tenderloin, the Theater District, you know, Chinatown, the Bowery with, you know, all the dance halls and the saloons. Yeah. So for me, it was, the idea was to take the Schuyler sisters, put them in Gilded Age New York, and then they go downtown and fall in love with their do-wells.
Yeah. I love it. Mm-hmm. Noble scoundrels.
Yes.
The best kind of scoundrels. But so that's what's amazing, because also, like, nobody had money like Gilded Age New Yorkers had money.
Truth.
Yeah. Like,
stupid money.
Crazy money. And built on actual work, right? Like, for,
it's, yeah, I mean,
they built railroads. I mean, Carnegie was not out there like hammering railroads.
Sure,
like,
no.
But there was a
work
certain
ethic.
Amount of, you can sort of lift it out in some ways of all of the like baggage that comes with a dukedom, right? It's like they're kings. I mean, we've talked so many times, like every romance hero has to be a king, but these are kings who like actually did work to make their money.
It's one of my favorite things, actually, about American historicals. And it's ironic because I'm, like, well known for not liking too much work in a romance.
Fossils.
But too many fossils.
Joanna and I are on a thread with all the other writers from the Rita Writers Room. And somebody, like, came on and was like, I'm trying to figure out this, like, plot point. And it was, like, very complex. And I was like, you guys, this is all fossils.
It's all fossils.
And, like, half the room only writes contemporaries. And they were like, what?
What?
The irony of this is I don't want to know about fossils or spreadsheets, but I do like characters that work, and I like characters that find value in themselves as workers. And every American historical, that is such a big part of our story.
Well, because they have to work. There are no idle. I mean, now there are many idle rich people in America. But
right.
In like early days when that stupid money was being made, these were not idly rich men.
No.
Or women, frankly. Like, the women were doing a ton of work behind the scenes to make sure the men could continue to make money. And I mean, like, we can talk about capitalism for days about, like, what we're saying about that. But the reality is like, money in romance novel, like, billionaire heroes sell for a reason.
And in the Gilded Age, there were no laws. I mean, there's no protections. There's no laws. There's no SEC. There's no, I mean, it's just every man for himself.
But there's also, like, no OSHA. So you can sort of start talking about, like, you can really dig deep on issues that feel relevant still in many ways. And also you can make your rich, stupid rich ne'er-do-well, like a noble guy in really interesting ways.
So, like, Jack Mulligan is really a, like, that character, right? And I know this is, like, you know, who knows if this will work for people, but the idea of, like, his criminal empire being built upon the idea that he has to take care of people is one that really worked for me.
Well, that's the mob. That's the genesis of the mafia and all gangs.
Right. I mean, his whole thing was, we can do it better ourselves. If we band together and stop fighting each other, we can take on who really matters. And that's, you know, we become powerful enough that the police can't touch us, the politicians can't touch us, and we are in control of our own destiny.
Which I've got to say, I've read The Devil of Downtown multiple times, even though I only have an arc, it's fine. But there's a whole subplot about the police not caring, about the plight of women, about them really being on their own, about this idea that they are just, you know, kind of crooked. There's some good cops, yes, but most of them, like the sort of the machinery of the police department is not there to serve the people. And, you know, that, you know, I read that and was like, true then, true now.
Sadly, mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. It was real, real corrupt.
Still, I mean, in New York City, this is the thing that blows people's mind. But like in New York City, it still is. I mean, we here in Brooklyn. So there is a community. There is like the New York City Democrats, the old school New York City Democrats, have a community system where block by block, you can. Essentially sign up to be the representative of the New York City Democrats on your block, literally your street, your one block.
Wow.
And the theory was this was invented to consolidate power around certain men in New York City. And so like what would end up happening is they would install on every block like a person who was in their pocket, and then that person would vote in community meetings for them. And like it would end up, and then if anybody went into this happened like several years ago, Eric was looking at like essentially like signing up for our block to be the community representative. And he went to a meeting of, you know, regular, normal, everyday Democrats, not New York City Democrats. And they said, it's really, really hard to get anywhere in that system because ultimately you end up like hitting a wall with like Boss Tweed style figures who are like, well, I guess if you want to help, you can come out to my business and help to hand out turkeys at Christmas. And it's like, that's as much help as I'm willing to accept from you. And it's New York City is entrenched in this like old school, everything that is in Joanna's books, still the seeds of it are still here. Chicago, too.
Well, one of the most amazing books I've ever read about Chicago is called American Pharaoh, and it's the story of the first Mayor Daley.
Yeah. Mm.
And I read it and was like, oh, that's what they mean when they talk about the machine, right? Like sort of the democratic political machine and how it worked at a street level. And if you were at all interested in like sort of city, I mean, it reads like a novel because it's like one of those things where you read it and you think, if this was in a book, people would be like, too heavy-handed, dial that back a little bit, you know? And it's so fascinating that I love having stories that like tap into this like really fascinating history. Like you said, people think they know this history and they don't.
Joanna, you are doing right now, I want to plug this because I noticed this morning, I never go to Facebook, and this morning I went to Facebook and I saw this. You're doing the history of the book.
Yes, right. Well, it's funny because I was taking this webinar that I paid for, and it was like about the history of, you know, Five Points or whatever. And I was like, man, I could give this webinar. Like, I was like, yep, yeah. That's in my book. Yep, that's in my book. And I was like, oh, I wonder if people would be interested if I showed it, like if I put together like sort of like the bones of the book and here's what Five Points is, here's what the Tenderloin is, here's what I mean by Uptown, here's what I mean by Downtown. And so I happened to ask my reader group on Facebook, like, is this something you guys would be interested in? And they died.
They were so excited. And tell everybody when it is.
It's Thursday, July 9 at 7 o'clock Eastern Standard Time on my Facebook page, which is just facebook.com Joanna Shoup author.
We will link to Joanna's Facebook page in show notes. But it sounds awesome and I'm absolutely going.
Yay.
And that's the cool thing. I mean, this is the other reason why I love historicals that are, I mean, for me personally, I love them because like, I don't write outside of, you know, a very specific place. And so, like, the research that I do is about that very specific place. And it's always fascinating to me when I turn up a historical that's about a place and a time that I don't know a ton about. And I think that that's something that's really interesting, too, for because it always feels to me like Jen and I have talked about this on the podcast before, but I think a lot of there's a sort of barrier to entry with historicals that is like, oh, I feel like it's going to feel like school for readers.
Right.
And then at the same time, so I wonder if sometimes there's that. It's sort of, that's a model, that's a mental model I'm unable to make. Like, I can't see downtown New York in 1890, so I won't, and it'll be too much work to read this book. But the reality is like, these are super sexy characters who are, like, the Prince of Broadway is about two, like, essentially, like a woman who wants to run a casino for women who goes to the biggest casino owner in New York City and is like, I need you to teach me. And then they just are sexy together for 400 pages. Amazing. I mean, it's absolutely remarkable. And then at the end, you're like, now I want to read every book about the history of New York City casinos.
Same. So let's talk about, at the end, maybe we'll have you sell Devil of Downtown a little bit since this will be coming out. But let's talk about some other books that we think, like, are, you know, have that
feel. Sure. Why don't you start since you are cruise directing?
I love Jeannie Lynn's historicals. Mm-hmm. And I think I've talked about one before, like back in season one, but not everyone listens to everything and there's no time like the present, is she has a really, she's written a lot of different like subgenres too. She has a steampunk series, but her Tang Dynasty series is one of my favorites. And the third book in the series is called My Fair Concubine. And this is set in 9th century China. It's like 842 or something. And it is a terrific series. And in this third book, I love a story about like two people who are going to like band together in some sort of, we're going to trick some people, right? And so in this case, the hero's name is Fei Long. And the book starts off with him discovering his sister, who he has not seen in years. Their father has died, and she's, like, having an affair with someone, and he, by all rights, should be able to, like, kill this dude, but instead he lets them go. But it puts him in a lot of hot water because his sister was supposed to marry someone from, like, a nearby, like, country. Essentially, the emperor of China at this time was using arranged marriages as a way of, like, I don't know, like, smoothing out international conflicts. And so he's really stuck because now his sister is gone. And what happens is he runs into this young woman, Yan Ling, at a tea shop. He gets her fired, essentially, and then agrees, like, they're going to work together and she's going to pretend to be his sister and, you know, sort of take on this new life. She's an orphan. She doesn't have anybody. So he's offering her this chance to, like, essentially, like, learn how to be, pretend to be like a sort of imperial young woman and get married. And of course, in the process of them faking it, right? Her learning how to do calligraphy. I mean, he like holds her hand and shows her how to do brush strokes. they fall in love. And it is such a terrific series. And it is just a really, I just love the, like, the lushness of, like, their life together and the description of Imperial China at this time. And it's a fantastic series. And it's old. It's old. I think she probably wrote this 10 years ago, at least.
Yeah, at least. Her writing's beautiful, though.
Those, I think, were Harlequin.
Mm-hmm.
These are. They're Harlequin set in 1842 in the Qing Dynasty. I don't know if I said that correctly, but in China. And they are steampunk, the Gunpowder Chronicles. And the last one was published in 2017.
Joanna, you also were going to talk about some of your favorites.
Yes. Well, just for to give people who are eager for like a non-New York setting, Felicia Grossman writes Gilded Age books set in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
Jennifer Halleck writes Gilded Age late 19th century set in the Philippines. Loretta Chase has a book set in Egypt. Joanna Bourne's The Black Hawk is set mostly in France and has all kind. It's one of the most amazing books ever written. If people haven't
Joanna
read that.
Joanna Bourne's The Black Hawk is one of those books that people talk about as transformative for them.
Yes.
And a lot of people, I personally don't read spies. As everyone knows, I'm on the record for not reading spy books. But I have read The Black Hawk and it is lovely. It is like a great book. If it's, you know, if you like a spy book, it's a great book. But people really love Joanna's books. And so if you are a spy lover, you'll never get an interstitial about it from us, but you should.
Jen, if you haven't read it, you should read it.
I've read the
Spymaster's Lady.
I read the Spymaster's Lady.
Spymaster's Lady. I've read that one too.
Yeah, that one's good.
Let's put it this way. The Joanna Bourne books are the books that I have read because everyone said, oh, well, you don't like spy books, but Joanna Bourne. And I appreciate that Joanna Bourne is technically perfect, but it's still spies and I don't care.
So we all have our lines.
We already talked about Alyssa Cole's Loyal League series, which is set in the Civil War, and that's spies, and that's a fantastic series.
But Alyssa is a gorgeous writer. So
I want to talk about her novella.
Yes,
that is set in 1917 Harlem. Let Us Dream.
Oh my God, it's so good.
And
it's so good.
I very often people will say like, oh, I wish you know. There were more books set like in the Jazz Age, and I wish I could read, you know, this book is
everything you want. Yeah.
Perfect. Everything you want.
Alyssa was on our novella. We did a novella interstitial and she was our guest. And one of the things that kept that I really keep thinking about now, even, you know, right now I'm writing a novella and Alyssa might be the best novella writer out there right now.
I was going to say that,
she is so good at telling that novella story in a lush, rich way that somehow makes you feel like you've really eaten a whole meal while also making you, like, giving it to you in just such a tiny bite.
Right, because the problem with novellas is that you can feel like
something's missing.
Yeah, you don't get the connection between the two characters enough. Like, they haven't known each other long enough. They haven't, you know, there's not a strong romance there, but Alyssa nails it every time.
Yeah. So, I'm sorry, go on, explain, but now tell everybody about the novella.
Yeah, so Bertha owns a cabaret in Harlem where she sometimes performs. The hero is Amir. And he's Indian. He's come to America for sort of the promise of more. And then he's disappointed when he gets to America to learn that, you know, there are all these barriers to that promise. He has trouble finding work and he's hassled by the police, but he's worried about the immigration officers. She hires him as a dishwasher, and then he kind of begins to cook. So it's that food as love theme that we all love, where, you know, he's taking care of her by feeding her. And they make this deal where he wants to learn about the politics of America. So he listens in on her lectures that, you know, she's giving to the girls of the neighborhood. And then he teaches her how to dance. And Alyssa's doing so much work here about the suffrage movement, about, you know, the white women really excluding the black women from the conversation of suffrage, the immigration laws at the time, the way that black business owners were harassed at the time, and how, especially women, how they were treated. And my favorite part of the book is he asks her at one point, don't you get angry at your country knowing that these things happen and no one does anything to stop it? And she says, if I hated it, that would be admitting that they broke me. I love it. It's perfect. Everyone should read it.
It's a great novella. It's a great novella.
It is.
That was part of the Daughters of the Nation anthology that I think we've talked about on the podcast before, but we'll link to the other three novellas that were there, that were in that anthology also in show notes. But that whole anthology was about black suffrage. And one of the other authors in that anthology was Piper Hewley, who was one of my picks for today. Piper writes inspirational romances, and we've talked about this before, but I don't read a ton of inspirational because it's a part of romance that I just don't read very much of. But Piper writes inspirationals set in the American South. And this one, A Champion's Heart, is set in the South in the 1920s. And the hero is a boxer who, so of course, like,
You're near and dear to my heart, all in.
So the premise is that the heroine, we sort of open on the heroine, and she is praying to God to forget this boy that she loved, who left her, I don't know, 6 or 7 years earlier. And his name is Champion. That's his name.
That's great.
That's a great name. And he left her, we discover, to win his fortune. He took himself and his fists off into the world to fight for his fortune so that he could come back and give her the life she deserved. But he's been gone for 6 or 7 years, and she's not sure he's coming back, and she's just desperate to forget him so that she can move forward in her life. And it's like instantly you're sort of in this moment where you think like, oh, it's just everything that you kind of want in a second chance, like where the love is just so clearly there and he's already doing everything he can to get her back. Right. And then he comes back. He turns up, of course, and he's going blind from the fights. And he,
oh, wow.
And so he is sort of in this place where he thinks he knows he has one last fight in him, and it's like for big money. And if he wins it, then he can retire and give Dealey, the heroine, the life that she deserves. And it is really, really beautiful. There's a whole sort of through line of about leaving the South and like what it is to be a black woman who has an opportunity to leave the South and make a new life in the North.
Sure, this would have been the Great Migration, right?
But she's got this sort of long, the whole beginning is her sort of trying to deal with the fact that Champion, like, if she leaves, he'll never come back to her. Like, he'll never be able to find her. Piper is a professor, and she builds up this really rich world that, you know, as a white kid in America, I never learned about, you know, what was happening in the South in the 1920s. And so for me, this book is really transformational in terms of the way that I think about romance in different places. I had never read anything like it, and it's really, I think, beautiful.
Piper's very talented.
Very talented.
I think setting is something that we really take for granted.
Yeah.
And I don't want people to. I think, like, the fact that, you know, reading anything is really determined by, like, time and place. And, you know, I think that even like a medieval, I guess, that I would like to briefly talk about is Elizabeth Kingston's The King's Man, which I actually listened to on audio. And I like listening on audio, but I almost exclusively reread books in audio. So I'm like listening to a book I already know because I'm not a very good listener. I like, you know, I don't, and also I read so much faster than I can listen, but I like listening to audio at like one. I don't speed it up. I'm not in a rush. If I'm listening on audio, it's like, I want it to like, I really want to like bathe in the language. That's what I'm doing. But The King's Man, I think I was like going on a drive. I just needed to have something to listen to. And someone said it was a really good audiobook. And it really is a fantastic audiobook. It's set in Wales in like the 13th century, I think. And it is about a young woman named Gwenllian, who essentially she's a virgin widow. She was sort of had an arranged marriage, and this husband she never met essentially died before they could, you know, consummate the marriage. And in the interim, her mother has taught her to be this like kind of leader of men, and she's a swordswoman. And she falls in love with this Rainulf, who is English. And the story, and, you know, it's really interesting. Like, he's like, she's ugly. She thinks she's whiter. These men listen to her. There's all this sort of cultural clash. But a lot of it, because it's Welsh, you know, I was kind of like, I don't know these words or these names. And so I also think in audio, it's such a fantastic audio experience because I didn't have to like struggle with like, am I saying this name right or this place right? And so I also found that for me, listening to audio, especially if there's like a language difference, right, or like place name difference. So in this case, this book is also really good in audio. But, you know, it's them. I think a lot of these stories, too, almost always are about like one person has a family and one doesn't. And sublimating the one person into the family structure that the other one has is, I don't know, like those. That plot is so common in historicals, and I think it's just really interesting the way this book plays with that. And also the Jeannie Lynn book that I talked about earlier is sort of the same. But I mean, even when I think of Joanna about your series, The Uptown Girls, what does it mean to be bringing these, like, you know, bad guys into the pristine family structure of the Greens?
Well, right. And that's why I thought the epilogue of Devil of Downtown was so important, because you had to see like how that all sort of came, how it all comes full circle. It would have been awkward. Me thinks it would have been pretty awkward.
Poor Duncan Green.
Yeah.
That's their dad.
He deserved it.
Yes.
He did deserve it. He did.
Well, I had another two. I had Emma Barry and Genevieve Turner's Free Fall, too. Oh, again.
That series, so good.
It's so good. The series is called, now you've chased it from my mind, it's like Men in Space. It's not Men in Space. That's a terrible name for a series. Anyway, the Free Fall is set during the space race in the early 1960s, right. And it's part of a five or six book series. You don't have to read them in order at all. But it's essentially a bunch of astronauts and other people related to the space race. And it's called Fly Me to the Moon, the series, not Men in Space.
Thank God you were not charging me that one.
I was not, thankfully. So this one is set in Houston, Texas, obviously, because it's, you know, the space race in 1965.
Remember when Joanna was like, and then he teaches her to cook because food is love.
Yeah.
There's no fucking Jell-O molds in this goddamn book, though, right? Nobody is like bringing out their weirdo 60s dishes.
No, that's a really good point. You would think that there would be like a potluck or something.
Something.
Right. Somebody crinkled up the potato chips instead of the cornflakes on the tuna casserole. And that was love back in the Houston of the 70s, because you know that shit was happening. But no.
Everything wiggled on that potluck table. Absolutely everything had a wiggle. The hero is Dean Garland, astronaut extraordinaire, who, and there's been a very dramatic occurrence at the space department.
At NASA, Sarah?
Whatever, fine. Who cares? It's fossils. I don't care.
It's true. It's fossils.
It's fossils. Whatever. At the space department. Anyway, so there's been a thing, and NASA has basically said, like, hey, men, you need to settle down and, like, focus up on work. Like, this is, we are in a race to the moon, and you need to understand that, like, everything else takes second seat. Except there's a problem in that Dean has, there's an accidental pregnancy, and Dean has to get married. Because it also happens to be the he's like knocked up the girl, the daughter of the company that makes the spacesuits. So, I mean, he can't exactly just walk away from her. Like, this is serious business. And so she's adorable. And they had this kind of like hot one night thing. And she got pregnant. And now they're married, like shotgun wedding married. And so he's like, but OK, fine. I don't have time for a wife. I don't have time for all the things that happen with a wife, particularly the stuff in the bedroom, because it's so distracting. And so we're going to live in like a sexless, loveless marriage. We'll deal with the fact that we're married after I get to be the first man who goes to the moon, the first man on the moon or walk in space. And so she's like, that doesn't work for me. I would like for you to love me and I would like for us to do it. And so she basically like sets out to make him love her and like seduce him and make him want her. And it's really soft and gentle, and ultimately everything works out and it's just really nice. But also, I have not read a book, a romance novel set after 1920.
Oh yeah.
Ever. So again, one of those moments where I was like, shit, I didn't even know we could write romance novels in the 60s.
Right. Does that count as historical though?
The rule is less than 40 years, more than 40 years. So the 1980s.
Wow.
The early 80s are on the table starting next year.
Making me feel real old.
Yikes.
Me too.
Yikes.
They meet at a Madonna concert, I guess.
That's making me feel real old.
Very soon.
Yeah, in one of the novellas in the series has a really excellent marriage in trouble where these two are essentially completely estranged and they find their way back to each other over Thanksgiving. And it is delightful.
Yeah, I just really like this series because I think, first of all, there's something really, well, first of all, it is super unusual. Like, it is real weird to be reading about the 1960s in a romance novel. And frankly, it's kind of weird to be reading about the 1960s in any novel. Like, I feel like there's just nobody's writing. No, there are these blackout years, it feels like, in fiction where there are things that you can write sort of recent, like the recent past, and then you can write the far away past, but the sort of middle past doesn't happen as much. I just think that's really cool. And I mean, you know, of course we come back to again and again, this question of there are so many opportunities in the world for us to write romance novels in time, in place, and still we're stuck in this tiny time frame, the lion's share of historicals. And it just doesn't make very much sense to me.
When I have been checking NetGalley lately, which for those of you that it's like a platform for books for reviewers, Harlequin historicals have had like, I have not read any of them, but they seem to be really flirting with like different times and places. So there's one that's coming out in July called The Flapper's Baby Scandal.
Ooh.
Wait, The Flapper.
From Harlequin what?
Harlequin Historical.
Oh.
Oh.
It comes out next month.
The Flapper's Babysitter?
The Flapper's Baby Scandal.
Babysitter. That is a makes different more book.
Sense. That's a different book. That's the Boxcar Children.
Baby Scandal.
Yeah.
The Sisters of the Roaring Twenties. It's a series. Yes,
exactly. The first one's called The Flapper's Fake Fiance.
Oh, now wait, though. This is not Harlequin Historical originally. This is Mills and Boone brought over. The UK romance market is very different. But I remember when I sold to the UK, somebody saying to me, like, don't get excited. Like, and yeah. When you go to the UK, there is no romance in bookstores at all. Like,
really?
I don't know where people are getting their romance novels because they are not getting them from bookstores. I must have been in 20 bookstores the 2 weeks after my release date last year, because I was in England for release, and nowhere.
Didn't matter, huh? Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, so I guess I would say maybe if you're interested, I cannot speak to the quality or...
I'm buying this.
It's really interesting to me that there, when I look at NetGalley now, there's a lot of books that seem to be outside of that Regency, and I don't know how they're selling and whether or not we'll keep seeing it, but
oh my god,
I'm curious about them.
Joanna, this is your jam. Patsy Dreyer may be a biddable heiress by day, but nothing will stop her from dancing all night in Hollywood speakeasies or fulfilling her dream of becoming a reporter. She's investigating the mystery of an escaped convict with brooding, handsome newspaper editor Lane Cox. Until they must pretend to be engaged.
Yes, yes, yes.
I mean, 100%. Put it in my veins.
Yes.
Also, I want her to talk like, I want her to do one of those like old-timey New York reporter talks. Yes.
And you, sir, what do you think you're doing here?
If the audiobook of that book does not include that voice, then I don't want it.
Then forget it.
And then they have not done their jobs properly.
Did you guys ever see the Hudsucker Proxy?
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah.
And Jason Lee's whole character. That's all I want from every 1920s book.
Not just potatoes, Smitty. Here comes the gravy. The chump really likes me. A Muncie girl.
Yeah, I mean, it's Rosalind Russell in His Girl Friday.
Yes.
I mean, I want that like all the time.
I think, you know, here's what I would say is we wrap up, I think there are choices out there. They're still not enough.
No.
Right? Like, I think yesterday I saw someone on Twitter saying, I'm looking for someone, I think an author who's writing like black queer historicals, and I can think of this one book.
Yep.
So please keep in mind that, you know, again, the book.
Send me that tweet because I have an answer Rebel Carter wrote a lesbian. Oh, yeah. Is that the one? Is that the one
might
book?
Have been. It might have been the one book, right? So I guess I would just say, you know, keep in mind that if you're interested in this topic, then the answer is to buy these books.
Yeah.
Right? Buy Beverly Jenkins' books, buy Joanna's books, buy Rebel Carter's books, right? Buy E.E. Ottman's books. Find ways to buy the books that are this, because that's how you show that there's a market for them.
Yeah. I mean, when I say, like, oh, Scotland doesn't sell, I mean, Scotland sells way better than most of these other markets, but it's because, and I know, because I can hear you all through the internet saying, but I love Gilded Age, I love the whatever. It's true, but the numbers, like, we just need to buy more of them.
Well, and Joanna, while we wrap up, tell us about my baby Jack Mulligan. Sell it to us, because it's amazing.
The Devil of Downtown is the third book of the Uptown Girls series. It is the third green sister, the youngest, the baby, and the Justine. The hero is Jack Mulligan, who is like the biggest criminal kingpin in New York City at the time.
Yeah.
He's based on a real life historical figure.
Probably less sexy.
Yes, definitely. Paul Kelly, who actually did really consolidate all the gangs into New York into one organization that he, you know, masterminded. So it's really, he's like really the start of what we consider the American mob. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Jack is getting his manicures and
I love it.
He wants to open a he's like a dandy. He dresses, you know, he speaks several languages. He dresses really, really fine. His goal is to open a national brewery because sort of beer production in the late 19th century really becomes national. So Justine is a do-gooder. She's out trying to save the world any way she can. And so she's downtown serving in soup kitchens, volunteering in missions, anything she could do for the Legal Aid Society. And she's out trying to track down wife deserters, which in those days were just men who just decided, I don't really feel like being married anymore and being a father, so peace out. Because it was real hard to get a divorce in those days. So there were a lot of men who just up and left. And she's out trying to find them and bring them to the police and force them to sort of do their due diligence to their family. And that's how she comes across Jack. And romantic times ensue, I guess.
And then they're just sexy together for 400 pages.
Here's what you need to know about this. If you were to, like, say, like, pull some things out of a hat that you'd be like, you could never make this sexy. One of the things on my list
I know what you're gonna
would be
say.
Bowling. Would be bowling. I'm not going to lie to you. You'd be like, could you make bowling sexy? And I would be like, no. Because I'm thinking of, like, what is that movie?
Oh, The Big Lebowski. Sure.
So, but I was wrong, everybody. I was wrong. That's all you need to know. You have an old, you have your own bowling alley in your house. It can get real sexy. Yeah, that's what you need to know.
I mean, there's balls, there's holes. I don't know. It just feels like...
I think that's great. I think we're there. There's balls.
Start as you mean to go on. There's balls and holes.
Amazing.
So, yeah, there's bowling. There's bowling.
We've really done a great job selling this. It's super hot, too. If you've never read a Joanna Shoup novel, you are missing out on the sheer fire of a Joanna Shoup novel.
I think the other thing I really enjoy about Joanna Shoup novels is, like, this Gilded Age New York. When they describe his home, I'd like to imagine how much that home would cost now.
Oh, I mean, oh. Yeah. I mean,
$1 billion.
Right? Multiply it by, like, 27 or, you know, whatever the rate of inflation is. I mean, it's crazy.
That is one of the writing historicals, running money into historicals is one of the hardest things because money never seems impressive. And if you tell it true, and then if you tell it false, you get hate mail from readers. If you're like, he made millions of dollars, millions of pounds, in a year, they're like, that's impossible.
And you're like, yeah, but...
But, like, also, it's not impossible. There's a... When I wrote my casino series, I based it on a real casino owner. And, like, the legend is that he could make £1 million in a night in, like, 1814. Which,
whoa!
I mean, huge money.
Okay, well... Thank you for listening to us talk about all this business. I love an unusual historical. So to Sarah, if you have any you would like to recommend to us, we would certainly love to hear about them. But more urgently and more importantly, I don't even know. I don't know how I got to this far in the podcast without saying, fuck yeah, Florence. Because Florence Green, the heroine of The Prince of Broadway, which was like one of my favorite books of the past year, bar none, and Devil of Downtown is like right there, has a heroine named Florence, and fuck yeah, Florence is basically like my calling card if I just want to like channel my inner like badass.
So, Joanna, tell everybody where we can find you on the internets.
So I'm pretty much Joanna Shoup on Twitter and Instagram, Joanna Shoup author on Facebook, joannashoup.com. If you want to order signed books from my local indie, that's Words with an S in Maplewood, New Jersey. Just put in the comments you'd like me to sign your book and I'll sign it.
If you are listening to this on release day, on Wednesday, June 24th, Joanna and I are doing an AMA and conversation about both of our books, which are both out next Tuesday in the OSRBC Book Club on Facebook. That's facebook.com/groups/OSRBC. We're recording it. So if you're reading it, if you're listening to this after the fact and you want to go back and listen and you're into hearing more about both of our books, you can go do that there.
I can't wait.
Yeah, we both have books out next week. I'm super excited. Who else has it? It's us. Caroline Linden has a new book out next
Vanessa
week.
Vanessa Riley.
And Vanessa Riley. So we are, it's historical excitement all week long next week.
And I just have to say how much I love Daring and the Duke, and everybody should buy it and read it.
Thank you.
Because
thank you very much.
Ewan is the best. The best.
Joanna dealt with me tearing my hair out on that book, so she's being very kind. Okay, so we are Fated Mates. You can find us on Twitter at Fated Mates, on Instagram at Fated Mates Pod. If you're on Facebook, join that OSRBC group. There is a chat every Wednesday. Tell us about a book that blooded you. This is the end of our season. We are wrapping up. We have a few more episodes, and then we're going to start fresh in August with a season 3. We're not doing any more read-alongs this season, but we still want to hear about the books that blooded you. Call us and let us know. That number is 646-450-3766. Our show is produced every week by Eric Mortensen. Our logo and all the buttons and swag and stickers and cool stuff that you can get from Fated Mates are designed by best friend Kelly of Resistance Buttons, and you can go to Jen's website, jenreadsromance.com, to buy those, or you can visit the Fated Mates website, fatedmates.net, click on merch, and it'll take you everywhere that there is to go. Also on that, on the website are transcripts, which are coming slowly but surely, and the Spotify playlist for all the music that gets inserted into the podcast, and a, you know, endless video player that will play the videos of all the music that gets inserted into the podcast. Fated Mates stickers and buttons. There's a Sarah pack and a Jen pack. And yes, and pre-order or no. Yeah, pre-order. Coming out next week, June 30th, pre-order The Devil of Downtown by Joanna Shoup from Words Bookstore in New Jersey, or pre-order my book, Daring and the Duke, from Word Bookstore in Brooklyn, and get a limited edition Fated Mates sticker. This took a long time. We have to shorten it. But we love you. Stay tuned for somebody's voicemail after this, and stay safe out there, everyone. Be good to each other.
Wear a mask.
Bye, guys.
Hi, Fated Mates. It's Eva here, and I'm calling because I've got two books that I really want to share with you guys. The first book that blooded me was the first romance I ever stumbled across when I was 12. And that's Warrior's Woman by Johanna Lindsay. And I recently did a reread in memoriam, since she's recently passed. And while there are certain things that don't hold up real well, i.e. the strong virgin heroine versus the big alpha male, and she constantly gets distracted by sex and just kind of forgets that she's a strong heroine, the fact that I read it at 12 meant I didn't catch a lot of that. But the idea that people were having sex, like, outside in the woods and on foreign planet, like, the sci-fi reader in me was 100% here for that. And it led to many, many hours holed up in the study carrels of my public library that summer, binge reading anything off of the romance shelf, because I couldn't bring those books home. So I read them very, very quickly, tucked away in my library. The other book that blooded me, though, I read as I was finishing college, and that one was Jewels of the Sun by Nora Roberts. You have a stressed-out perfectionist professor from Chicago who follows her roots back to Ireland in Grand's cottage and falls in love with a handsome bartender, but more importantly gives herself permission to write instead of teaching. And any of you who know my backstory, like, this book is kind of my life. I was a teacher for a while. Now I write romance. I'm living my own happily ever after. And this is one of those Nora books that I come back to over and over again because it just feels so pertinent to me. Although I do love Born in Ice, Brianna and Grayson forever. That end scene just kills me every time I read it. Anyhow, those are the books that blooded me. Thank you so much for all of the work that you do on Fated Mates. I love listening, even though I'm one of those weirdos who couldn't finish all the IAD books. I still love them all. And if you guys want to find me, I'm on Instagram at Author Eva Moore. Bye.